Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week, during our summer hiatus, we present interviews featured in previous shows, including Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, who discusses his group's campaign to restore public trust in Congress by fighting the influence of money in politics. Ken Green, founder of the Hudson Valley Seed Library, who examines the role of agribusiness in privatizing and monopolizing crop seeds and the resulting threat to biodiversity. And Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies, who discusses his book titled At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A report by a Burmese opposition group raises new concerns about the nuclear ambitions of Myanmar's ruling military regime. The report by the Democratic Voice of Burma, released in early June, cites evidence from former Burmese Army Major Sai Ten Win, including revealing photographs, secret memos, and equipment orders detailing a nuclear weapons program. These documents were analyzed by Robert Kelly, a former director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Kelly concluded, Myanmar's generals are mining uranium, converting it to uranium compounds that could be used for reactors and bombs. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the report was released at a time when the U.S. State Department is pressuring Myanmar's military regime to comply with United Nations Resolution 1874, which calls on member states to prevent North Korea from developing nuclear weapons. Washington's growing concern is based in part on North Korea's shipments of nuclear-related technology to Burma. The Burmese opposition has put a lot of faith in the material leaked by Major Sai. They compare the exiled former military officer to Israeli nuclear technician Mordecai Vanunu, whose photographs of Israeli nuclear sites were printed in the Times of London in 1986. Vanunu was later kidnapped by Israeli intelligence agents in Italy, tried in a secret court and sentenced to 18 years in prison, 11 of which were spent in solitary confinement. In anticipation of hosting future rounds of the World Cup and Summer Olympics, Rio de Janeiro police have launched a campaign to forcefully retake the favelas or poor urban slums that ring the city. According to The Nation magazine, a police helicopter was shot down last October during a firefight between police and rival criminal gangs. Three police officers and 12 civilians were killed in the incident. Typically, police enter a favela using deadly force in quick, brutal raids, but then just as quickly leave. However, under a new pacification program, the Brazilian government is planning to set up permanent outposts in the favelas and bring in social services such as healthcare and education to benefit the population living in these extremely poor slums. But police may have a hard time gaining the trust of favela dwellers. Human Rights Watch reports that Rio police officers killed more than 1,100 civilians every year, but only a handful of cops have been convicted of abuses over the last decade. Stanford University historian Robert Proctor, an expert on the history of tobacco, was shocked in 2009 to receive court papers accusing him of witness tampering and witness intimidation. He was also served a subpoena seeking the historian's unfinished book manuscript. According to The Nation magazine, Proctor got another subpoena demanding 3 years of email correspondence with another historian and his computer hard drive. These actions are part of tobacco giants R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris's efforts to prevent Proctor from testifying as an expert witness in Florida civil cases. Proctor is one of only two professional historians who testify on behalf of smokers with cancer against big tobacco companies in civil cases, while there are 40 other academics who regularly testify in support of tobacco companies. The harassment of Proctor and other experts who fight big tobacco is the latest chapter in ongoing litigation over the health consequences of smoking. In 1998, states' attorney generals agreed to a $246 billion settlement with big tobacco to pay for past health care expenses caused by smoking. Later, the Clinton administration filed a massive suit against tobacco companies. Now, civil cases are sprouting up in Florida, where the state Supreme Court disbanded a huge class action suit against tobacco companies. After months of hearings and the order to turn over his emails, the court found that Proctor did nothing improper. Florida courts also sided with Proctor in protecting his unpublished manuscript, saying the historian has the constitutional right to choose when and where his writings are published. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, companies that hired congressional lobbyists in 2009 spent more than $3.47 billion to influence legislators as they debated the future of health care reform, financial regulations, and energy policy. That constituted more than a 5% increase over the previous record expenditure of $3.3 billion spent on federal lobbying in 2008. The center calculated that $1.3 million were spent on lobbying every hour that Congress was in session during 2009. This flood of corporate spending to influence Congress came as the U.S. was suffering through the worst economic decline since the Great Depression. Public opinion polls indicate most Americans aren't happy with the status quo in Washington, with more than 60% saying that federal legislators don't deserve to be reelected. Several other polls find that the public's approval for Congress and political parties are now at historic lows. Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig is co-founder of the nonprofit group Change Congress, whose mission is to restore public trust in government and protect the independence of Congress by fighting the influence of money in politics. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Lessig about how his group proposes to change the status quo in Washington, where big money has veto power over congressional action on behalf of the public good.
Well, it's a kind of corruption that's different from corruption that was pretty common in the 18th and 19th century, the kind of bribery or quid pro quo corruption or the corruption of Rob Blagojevich or Randy Duke Cunningham. This is more a corruption of influence. And it comes because Congress is enormously competitive to each party trying to raise as much money as they possibly can to keep control of Congress. And that means that they spend between 30 and 70% of their time out there raising money, if not for themselves, then for somebody else in their party. And as anybody recognizes, if you're spending that much time focused on what big funders want, you can't help but be corrupted from the underlying job that you're supposed to be doing, which is to be dependent not upon your funders, but upon the people. And so this behavior, this dance that they dance, leads most people to believe that they're in fact not so much concerned about what their constituents want and mainly concerned about what makes their funders happy.
Now, with the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which really gave carte blanche to big corporations and other less wealthy nonprofit groups to spend as much as they want to influence campaigns, could it be that this kind of swamping of the political system with no holds bar, an infusion of money that the likes of which this country has never seen, could that turn around public apathy and actually involve citizens in trying to change what is, you know, viewed ever more as an untenable anti-democratic system?
It could, and I think it will, if we give the people a clear alternative that they can work for. I think one of the most depressing facts about the Democratic leadership in Congress and the president is that rather than pursuing a bold idea about how to change the system and make it into one that people can believe in again, they're tinkering at the margins. You know, this is the classic arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. So the Democrats and the president want more transparency. They want to make it easier for people to, the president proposed, track down who got earmarks. And all of those, of course, are good. Nobody would argue against transparency. But the idea that making it easier for people to use the Internet to find out how money affected politics is going to make them believe in politics more is extraordinarily naive. What has to happen is a fundamental change in the economy of influence that governs how members get elected. And what that means is citizen-funded elections. And if we had that, which there are now 135 co-sponsors in the House for a bill that would do exactly that, then at least people could begin to believe that the reason Congress did what it did, whether it, whatever stupid thing they did because they were too liberal or too conservative, but not because of the money. And that's the first step, once again, to restoring faith in this democracy.
Professor Lessig, you point out that this is not just some abstract argument or fight about the ideals of democracy, that there are real-life consequences for us here as a nation and a world. And you point out that with this economic collapse caused in large part by deregulation, propelled by the money in Congress that pushed that deregulation, and the other major environmental issue of climate change and the forces arrayed against changing the current energy system, which will surely get us all into hot water with real dire consequences for life on the planet, that this really is, again, not some kind of parlor game, but there's really life and death issues here.
That's right. And, I frankly blame all of us for not being more aware of how this systemic problem needs to be solved. We've got to connect the dots. Some of us care about healthcare. Some of us care about global warming. Some of us care about, a financial system that doesn't send the economy over the cliff. Whatever you care about, you need to begin to recognize we're not going to get any of this reform until we fix this first problem first. And, people have got to put aside their own personal pet issue and begin to devote the energy we need to focusing on this first problem first. And if we do that, obviously a democracy has the opportunity to make this change, but it's going to require a kind of courage and devotion that, we've not seen in this democracy for many years.
That was Harvard University law professor Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edward J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics and co-founder of the group Change Congress. Visit the Change Congress website at fixcongressfirst.org. Most people don't think much about the significance of seeds, but one speaker at the March 6 conference of the Connecticut chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, or NOFA, maintains that seeds are responsible for the development of civilization itself, because food crops enabled humans to evolve from hunter-gatherers to farmers, leading to settled communities and the growth of cities. Ken Green is the founder of Hudson Valley Seed Library, based in the village of Accord, New York. During a workshop at the NOFA conference, Green examined the history of seeds, which for millennia were saved from one year's harvest and planted the next. But with the growth of giant multinational conglomerates like Monsanto, the life of seeds has changed dramatically. When companies patent hybrid seeds, they become private property, which means saving them for the next season becomes illegal. Now, farmers and gardeners are forced to purchase new seeds every year from giant corporations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Green about the history of seeds, the role of private enterprise, and the fight back in the form of seed exchanges and seed banks.
One of the challenges that we've taken up with the Hudson Valley Seed Library is that, food security has become this big buzzword. How are we going to feed people? How are we going to make sure that communities can provide food for themselves? Food, which right now is distributed over many, many miles, how can we be more regional about it? And feed more people. And it's interesting to see that for some people the answer, they're talking about GMOs, when of course with a GMO, it's illegal, they're patented, it's illegal to save your own seed. So if we can't save our own seeds from the plants that we're growing to plant them again, how is that a secure food system? And how is that a sustainable food system? It's not. Because we have to rely on the technology and profit-driven motives of a multinational corporation to dictate what can be grown and how it's grown. And we have to get seed from them every year, and it's expensive seed. So when I started the seed library and I was trying to encourage people and get them to start trying to save seeds, on their own, and I started realizing that along with losing the genetic diversity, which is so important, by becoming more dependent on hybrids and GMOs, that we're also losing the seed-saving skills. So many people were saying to me, I don't know how to do this. And if we lose the skills, then we lose our ability to be self-sufficient in terms of food production. So, you know, that's why when we're offering seeds through the seed library and through our online catalog, that everything we offer is open pollinated. And we don't offer any hybrids, and certainly we don't offer any GMOs, so that people can save their own seeds. And we're running the library part of it. It's participatory, so that people can save their own seeds, send them back to us, and then we can mix them with the other seeds that come back from other seed library members and then send them back out, so that we're all sharing the genetic diversity and that we're all cooperating to make sure that we are in charge of our own food sources.
Ken Green, you were talking at the workshop about how multinational companies are basically raiding the seeds that are used by indigenous peoples. Can you say more about that?
Well, this is there's sort of a word to describe it now. It's called biopiracy. And it's basically for plant breeding, the more genetic material you have, the better. Because you never know what you're going to be looking for as pests and disease change, as climate changes, as what crops become more important or less important change. It's important to have sort of a full palette, genetically speaking, to work with. So, you know, it's not just now. For ages and ages, people have been traveling and finding new plants and collecting seed from them to have, you know, a seed bank, whether it's a government or a corporation. But what's happening now, the thing that's really changed about it is that corporations have really been pushing to be able to patent genes. And it started with the GMOs in terms of they were actually inserting technology, you know, technologically changing the genetic makeup of something, and so they could patent that. But what's happening now is there's, you know, a lot of movement and pressure from corporations that they want to be able to patent existing genetic makeups or existing single genes even. So they can go to whatever culture they want to where they see something that they think might be useful. They take the seeds and then they say, we want to patent it, but they're not recognizing that it's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years breeding work on the part of whatever culture they're taking that seed from that created that genetic makeup. So it was really somebody else's work. So why should they be able to patent it, you know, as a quote-unquote discovery when it exists because it exists within a culture and because of the work of a certain culture?
You have your seed libraries. There are other seed exchanges and seed banks. Is seed saving something that's growing, so to speak, and that might combat some of the negative tendencies we just talked about?
You know, I think on a grassroots level, in terms of home gardeners, saving seed and sharing seed with each other in any form, you know, even if it's just between neighbors or family or, you know, at your community center, it doesn't have to be a library or a bank or anything official. I think it's really important work for communities and important for us to be sharing those seed resources on a larger scale in terms of what's happening more globally. I think there are more organizations, non-governmental organizations, getting involved in these issues. But one of the things that we were talking about at the conference was that just because it's called a seed bank or a seed library or a seed exchange, there's no specific definition of those entities. So everyone does it differently. And there's something great about that in that you can tailor it to your community and to the people who are involved, but you also have to really look into it to see, like, what, you know, what does it mean? Who's benefiting from this? Who's behind this? What is it really for?
That was Ken Green of the Hudson Valley Seed Library. For more information, visit the group's website at seedlibrary.org. As 2010 begins, American workers are confronting some of the hardest times since the Great Depression. With unemployment in double digits, record home foreclosures, and bank loans difficult to secure, workers lucky enough to be employed often are forced to get a second and third job just to pay the rent, put food on the table, and handle soaring college tuition and health care costs. But U.S. corporate media, by and large, ignore telling the stories of working Americans, their struggles, and the sacrifices made. However, in his new book, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century, Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, paints a compelling portrait of workers making a living in four different industries in his state. In the spirit of prize-winning author Studs Terkel, known for his in-depth interviews with ordinary people, Jurevich takes us inside the lives of people from a variety of backgrounds, both citizens and immigrants, working at a Verizon call center, a fish processing factory, a hospital, and now a closed machine shop. Through these individual stories, the larger issues of corporate-led globalization and the declining power of unions that confront American workers can be better understood. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tom Jurevich, also an accomplished singer-songwriter, who describes the lives of the workers he interviewed and the common struggles they face to secure a decent wage, improve sometimes unsafe working conditions, and maintain their dignity on the job.
6 years ago, as I began to talk to people informally, you know, people in my neighborhood, my brother-in-law, people I not knew, it was clear that something was going on in the American workplace. So I took about 6 years and interviewed 85 people, not just for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but long interviews, 60 minutes, 75 minutes, a couple of hours in their homes, in diners and coffee shops. And it was really devastating, the kinds of stories that I learned about the American workplace.
Tom, as you talk to these workers over the number of years it took to write this book, At the Altar of the Bottom Line, what were some of the common themes that you heard over and over again from workers who are hanging on to, you know, good-paying or not-so-good-paying jobs and just trying to make ends meet, send their kids to school, you know, have some kind of health insurance? What were some of these common struggles that you heard from the workers?
Well, it is also, it's incredibly amazing when you actually listen to people. And one of the things I think we're so short of in the national media is this idea of the 1 or 2 minute soundbite. But when you sit down with somebody and have them the chance to talk, these kinds of things emerge that, in fact, completely shocked me, even though I'm a sociologist who spent my whole life working and studying work. But I think the other couple things that emerged are equally important. One is, despite these struggles, was how hard people worked to make their lives work for them and their families. This was not a group of workers who had given up in any way, or in some ways weren't even a group of whiners or complainers. They were all working very hard, and that included the Guatemalan undocumented workers who worked two full-time jobs, worked 80 hours a week to try to make ends meet for them and to send some money back home to their families. It included people doing all kinds of alternative schedules so that their families would work. So I think this is really also an important part of this about how hard people are still holding on to a dream for jobs with bread and roses. That phrase comes from a Massachusetts strike from 1912 where textile workers went on strike. And they said, yes, we need the money to be paid, the bread to feed our families, but we also need the roses. We need the dignity and we need the respect be able to both survive on the job, but also to have a life afterwards. And I think that's the third point that I'd like to make that came clear from these interviews, is just how hard it is for people to participate outside of their family in community life and civic life. When people are working 50, 60 hours a week, alternative shifts, are completely exhausted, completely stressed out, it's hard for them to participate in their communities and in political life. And many of them still do. They volunteer, as one of the nurses does, in a program to prevent handguns for violence among children. But it's finding it very hard. And I think that's one of the long-term things that we've got to really think about in this economy. It's not enough just to create jobs and have jobs, but we have to have jobs that allow people to build lives, full lives of bread and roses, and ones where they can be part of their community and build this country into a better place.
Tom Jurevich, as a professor of labor studies and a labor activist yourself, there have been times in our country's history where workers rose up, organized, and were the engine of improving their own lives. Do you see any opportunity in the near future where workers in this horrendous economy we're living through right now with this economic meltdown, could that be a trigger where people will take some steps to get the labor movement re-energized and reorganized to take back some ground that has been lost over recent decades?
Absolutely, Scott. I think, as my old friend Utah Phillips used to say, the most dangerous thing in America is the long memory. And I think if we actually look beyond just the last decade or two or three, what we realize is that in many ways the labor movement was born out of tremendous hardship and struggle, whether we're talking about the robber barons, whether we're talking about the Great Depression. So it's not that this is not the first time that working people have faced these kinds of incredibly difficult, hard times. But I think the thing we always need to remember is that, you know, a job in and of itself is not necessarily a good job or a bad job. Auto jobs never started out to be great, unionized, well-paid jobs. They were some of the worst jobs in this country. No different than the kinds of jobs we see now out there, whether we're talking about jobs at Walmart or other jobs in the service industry or among fish processors or nurses or call center workers. But what we recognize when we take that long view of history is it takes organizing in those industries. It takes collective action. And we've got to move beyond this sort of individualism to create some collective struggle. So I think that, you know, right now the labor movement is going through lots of transitions. I mean, we lost much of the industrial labor movement, which formed the core and the backbone of the labor movement. We've got some interesting things going on in the service sector and healthcare, and a lot of other unions. But I think we also need to branch out and to broaden the movement, both to include young people who are struggling in fundamentally different ways, and to also include workers in traditionally occupations that we haven't thought of in terms of the labor movement. So I think there's an awful lot of work to be done, but I think, as I say, we take that long view. It's not as though the labor movement is over in this country. It's not as though it's simply a vestigial organ of a long-gone past.
That was Tom Jurevich, professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of At the Altar of the Bottom Line, The Degradation of Work in the 21st Century. Visit his website at tomjurevich.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.